It's Lars. Thank you for checking out my podcast, and have a great day.
Lars. Together, we can forge a new beginning for America.
The 45th President of the United States, Donald J. Trump.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
And yes, together, we will make America great again. Thank you, God bless you, and God bless America.
Now, honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
And I never thought I'd play a baseball game for charity, go to practice at 6:30 in the morning, and have to dodge bullets. Republicans and Democrats need to use this day today to stand together and say, stop. Let's work together. Let's get things done. We can have our differences, but let's not let it lead to such hate.
How are you feeling right now?
I'm angry. You know, I got back to my office after obviously staying out there for what I thought was way too long, but necessary to, because it was a crime scene. I'd never been in one before. I went back to my office, and I took the chance to come down here because I want to talk to people about what I witnessed and about the effect that it should have as we move forward as a country. And that's why I'm here, bloodied, in my uniform still, not had a chance to go clean up, because it's that important that a message gets out that the hatefulness, this political rhetoric hate, and I would consider, we'll let the witnesses describe it, this could be the first political rhetorical terrorist act, and that has to stop.
That's what it's all about, a terrorist attack at a GOP charity baseball practice. The shooter, the terrorist, now dead, but Congressman Steve Scalise in critical condition at the hospital, along with four others, including two police officers who helped safeguard the lives of everyone at that baseball field this morning in Northern Virginia. Welcome to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to have you with me on this Wednesday, and I'm glad to take your phone calls and emails. It's 866-439-5277, your opportunity to join the best conversation in talk journalism. It is honestly provocative talk for the United States of America. And welcome to the program. In light of today's events, here's the quick poll tonight. Should America go to nationwide reciprocity for concealed carry? Your driver's license works in every state in America. Your CCW or CHP should work in every state in America as well. It's one of the campaign promises of our president. And there are members of Congress who have a bill that would make that happen. They just have to get about passing it and putting it on President Trump's desk. Tonight's quick poll, found at LarsLarson.com, brought to you by AMAC, the Association of Mature American Citizens, the kind of conservative values I believe in. Just go to amac.us to join, like I did years ago. Or you can join AMAC right now by calling 888-262-2006. AMAC is better, better for you and better for America. So many things going on in America today, but obviously the attention of the nation is on the recovery of those in the Capitol, and certainly we extend our thoughts and prayers to Steve Scalise's family and to all of the other families who are adversely affected by this. Lawmakers in New York are petitioning President Trump's Department of Justice for the deportation of one Nazi internment camp officer. What should be done to a man who facilitated the killings of so many people? Social justice warriors are not planning to slow down with their opposition to microaggression and pronouns. Well, now they can all huddle around their safe spaces. We can read a new handbook just for them. And Democrats are suing Donald Trump over his hotel income from overseas. They say it's unconstitutional. And by the way, cast a vote in my quick poll at LarsLarson.com. I know that a lot of you want to respond to what happened today in Virginia, so I'm going to go to your calls now at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk at LarsLarson.com. Lauren joins me from California. Lauren, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Thank you. Lars, I'd like to point something that's obvious. We keep hearing the hero status for the two Capitol Police officers there today, and their sole job is to protect Congressman Scalise.
Yeah.
The report I got on Congressman Scalise is he was shot.
Yes.
He's in critical condition.
Yes.
And everybody's throwing hero status around these guys. Now, I'm not saying that they're bad cops or bad people or anything like that, but their sole job was to protect the congressman, and in my opinion, they failed in their job.
Can I tell you why I think they did their job? Because the job of, say, a protective detail for a member of Congress is to protect you. while you allow that person to still go about their life. Now, you could protect a congressman very well. You could pick him up at his house, get him into a safe car, a car with protections built into it, drive him to his office, and never let him leave his office. But if you allow him to go out in public, and this was an event in public, he was at batting practice, you can't very well have the secret, the not Secret Service, but the Capitol Police protective detail go out and stand on second base with Congressman Steve Scalise the way he was. So when the shooting began, unless you're going to simply shelter members of Congress from any exposure to anyone else, then how would two police officers have protected that congressman?
Well, this gets to your reciprocity question that's coming out here.
Yeah.
People, they want to self-preserve. They want to, you know, we've been hearing the word hero and everything like that. I'm going to say they did their job, okay?
Well, to be under fire is heroic. I mean, because wouldn't you agree?
Well, if you want to, there was a bank robbery in Los Angeles in 1997.
Yeah,
and there was,
I remember,
police
it.
Police officers that ended that thing.
Yep.
They drove up there and attacked that guy and took him out. Those guys were heroes, because I'm telling you, that was unbelievable what they did. But what these two officers have done, and what we're hearing now, is they were behind the protection of their vehicle and firing.
Well, both of them were wounded, and one is actually in pretty tough shape tonight.
Well, we're not sure how, you know.
Both of those officers were wounded. So I guess if we hire somebody to put on a uniform and go out and do the job of being a cop, whether the cop is a federal marshal or, you know, or a local police officer or a sheriff's deputy, that officer knows that he's putting his life on the line. He may be shot. In fact, he may be shot in a surprise, and some cops are shot where the bad guy gets the better of them and shoots them before they have any chance to respond at all. But these two cops, both wounded, were under fire, but they returned fire, and they helped keep the bad guy's head down and keep him from shooting anyone else while a great many people escaped. If they had not kept their heads, and I imagine it'd be pretty tough to keep your head while you've been wounded, you're under fire, and there's a bad guy trying to kill you, but you shoot back to provide cover for the innocent lives you're trying to protect, I consider that heroic. Now, if you want to say that's just doing their jobs and we shouldn't thank them for it, I'm not going to subscribe to that. Sorry.
I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying the word hero gets thrown out. Virginia Tech, another example in there. The police, they were described as heroes. When there was shooting going on inside the classrooms, you could see the campus police there. They were behind the vehicles in there and ducking cover while there was
that's,
firing
and
going
that,
on.
That
they
may be another.
In
that may be
saving students.
And they were following protocol, which, by the way, you know that after Columbine High School and other incidents, the police changed their protocols so that they do go in and try to stop the active shooter rather than try to wait until they're properly staged outside. I think in the case today, those two officers are heroes, and God bless them for what they did. A wise person knows you have to be prepared for any kind of emergency. That can include a natural disaster. An earthquake or a hurricane, could be a long-term power outage, maybe one caused by an EMP, or being cut off from access to grocery stores due to protests or civil unrest. For those and many other situations, you need a plan for self-reliance. The actions you take today are important. Take a moment and secure your personal liberty and ensure you can feed yourself and your family. That's where My Patriot Supply delivers for me, and they will for you, too. Get their four-week survival food supply for just $99. Call 888-411-7290 or order online at preparewithlars.com. Prepare for the unexpected while things are still calm. You'll sleep better at night when you have a four-week survival food lifeline in your home. That's 888-411-7290 or preparewithlars.com. 888-411-7290 or preparewithlars.com. Coming up in just a moment, we've got lots to talk about. Will social justice warriors ever vanquish the hostile oppression of pronouns and microaggressions? We'll talk to Lisa De Pasquale, a columnist for The Federalist, about that oppression and what's going on. You've got the Lars Larson Show.
Good morning. Got something to say? Call 866-HEY-LARS to join the conversation now.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I decided on a day like today, when we've seen an act of political terrorism that put five people in the hospital, some of them grievously injured, and you want to send out a thought and a prayer to the families of all of those people, those who are there, those who are affected, you know, just please do that. But on a day like today, I decided we had to talk about something a little lighter. So we know that over the last couple of years, we've seen just how much the delicate snowflakes of American political society have become. And I thought I'd invite Lisa DePasquale on, who's a columnist for The Federalist. She's the former director of CPAC and the author of the upcoming book, and it's so wonderful, The Social Justice Warrior Handbook, a practical survival guide for snowflakes, millennials, and Generation Z. Lisa, welcome back to the program.
Hi, Lars. Thanks for having me.
So you're going to try and help these social justice warriors out by giving them a little armor against the kinds of things they may face out in the real world?
Yes. I mean, like, what to do if someone assumes your gender, and, you know, this way they'll be better prepared to deal with common sense folks like us.
You mean they look at you and they say, your name is Lisa, and you look kind of feminine, so we'll just assume you're a woman. And then it turns out Lisa isn't a woman, Lisa's a man. What do you do?
Well, you know, I start off with in the book because now, you know, especially the feminists that wanted government out of their life now wants government in every part of their life. And so I start off the book being totally honest and say, you know, my name is Lisa. My preferred pronouns are she and he and her. And because everyone wants to know everyone's, you know, sexual proclivities, I say I am attracted to toxic masculinity in males in the 40s and 50s. So I'm being totally honest, and, you know, everybody wants to be up front, so that's what I'm doing.
No, and some of these people need tools to deal with the world, because at this point, I know people, these folks apparently want to be taken seriously, but it really is difficult to take them seriously with this, my preferred pronoun is they, them, or their, or it, or something like that. I just, for the life of me, if you want to have that, you know, that self-identification, that's fine, but why force the rest of the world to go along with you?
Well, I think what you don't understand, Lars, is that they've solved all the other world's problems. The world's, you know, other
like
problems.
Hunger and energy and pollution and all that.
Violence.
Yeah.
You know, so now it's time to move on to the microaggressions. And, you know, and that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, is I'm trying to make political humor great again. Like, it doesn't have to just be assassinations and things like that. We can actually have a good laugh and, you know, not be mean-spirited. And, you know, laugh with each other. I mean, it's kind of like, I don't know if you remember the Preppy Handbook.
Oh, yeah.
From the 80s.
Oh,
where,
yeah.
Where, you know, at some point, the Preppy Handbook, preppies actually kind of liked it because they saw some truth in it. And they're like, yeah, we are kind of silly like that. Just like, you know, the $700, this is what a feminist looks like T-shirt. I mean, at some point, they have to admit that they're a little silly.
Well, and what about these social media activists? As you say, the only thing necessary for the triumph of good over evil is to tweet about it.
Yeah, and, you know, it's funny because, like, on one hand, we're making fun, but on the other hand, they really are having an impact. I mean, you see people with, you know, 15 or 20 followers somehow getting large corporations to drop advertising.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense, although I guess at some level, I kind of like the idea that the marketplace works, and if people start saying bad things about your products, even in the old days, that was a bad thing. People say bad things about you, they aren't going to buy your products.
Yeah, until it comes back and hits them, and they're like, why aren't people supporting, you know, our assassination porn play? Then all of a sudden, it's not a good idea.
Yeah, assassination porn play, would that include that New York production of, exactly. So those people need to have a little memo that suggests, did anybody during the planning session think about what the reaction was going to be when they pretended to assassinate Donald Trump on stage in New York City?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, a group of these social justice warrior types that, you know, they all want to one-up each other, and because they can't be funny or creative on their own, they just want to be, like, mean and gross, you know, especially when it comes to so-called art, which I'm not against any art as long as I don't have to pay for it.
No, I'm not either, although people seem to think that the First Amendment means I can have any art I want and nobody's allowed to react adversely to it. And I say, no, you're allowed any art you want, and I can react as adversely to it as I want to.
Yeah, exactly. And that's, I mean, the same with the marketplace. And, you know, it's just funny because I kind of want to say over the last, you know, couple weeks, especially with Kathy Griffin and then with Bill Maher and some other things, I want to, like, plaster on the front of the book. I wrote all this before all of this happened because the thing is they always follow the same playbook. I mean, literally in the book I write, you know, you do something and people criticize you, and I say, don't delete it, double down and claim you're the victim. And that's exactly what Kathy Griffin did.
She tried. Lisa DePasquale is the author, most recently, of the Social Justice Warrior Handbook, a practical survival guide for snowflakes, millennials, and Generation Z. What is a workplace warrior?
The workplace warrior is the type of person who complains about Taco Tuesday and say, you know, and says that's appropriating, you know, someone else's culture, even if no one else complains. And even if the person, you know, complaining is not Hispanic, you know, you're doing it, you know, on behalf of someone else. It's also the person that maybe on, you know, potluck day decides that, you know, you shouldn't bring any meat dishes and their contribution is like raw, vegan, non-GMO protein balls that no one wants.
Sounds delicious.
So that's your workplace warrior. And, you know, all of these overlap, and just like gender, your, you know, SJW identity is very fluid.
Now, what about the holiday meal survival, where you show up at mom or dad's house and the Thanksgiving dinner, Christmas dinner, Hanukkah dinner, or Eid after fast dinner doesn't follow your food philosophy? What do you do?
Well, you want to make sure that you question your host so that they feel like, despite, you know, providing you a nice meal, that you're always questioning just, you know, their decisions. Like, even if you know the answer that grandma's, you know, green bean casserole is not dairy free, like, still ask and then suggest, well, you know, you could use pureed cauliflower instead of heavy cream. And, you know, just be helpful and make people feel, you know, put out.
If only the pilgrims had Cuisinarts, they'd have been all set. Lisa, congratulations on this. It sounds like it'll be a lot of fun. I suggest you ship a complimentary box of these books to Evergreen College in Olympia, Washington. They've been having trouble lately, and I think they could use your advice.
Yeah, I don't know. I could be accused of a hate crime.
No, it might constitute a hate crime. Lisa, be well. Congratulations. It sounds like a lot of fun.
Thank you so much.
You bet. Glad to have you on. By the way, I've got a little advice for you. You know that Father's Day is this Sunday. Don't forget, dads are super hard to shop for. The challenge is always get him a great-looking gift, but don't break your bank. Well, this year, there are Harry's shave sets, and there's still time to get Dad the perfect gift from Harry's. No matter who you're buying for this year, save money with Harry's. I've always recommended Harry's just for day-to-day shaving because I started using them years ago. But check this out. For Father's Day, the limited edition Father's Day shave set includes a matte black razor handle, a chrome razor stand. It looks great, believe me. I bought a few of them. Harry's moisturizing foaming shave gel, three of Harry's handcrafted blade cartridges, and a travel cover to boot. It comes in a sleek giftable box with the option to add custom engraving and a personalized card for free. Just go to harrys.com right now and redeem a special offer for fans of my show. Harry's will give you $5 off. Just use the word Lars when you go to the site. Father's Day is this Sunday. Time's running out. Order today. H-A-R-R-Y-S. harrys.com. Enter Lars at checkout to get $5 off. And from Harry's, always get a great shave. Coming up, one of my favorite science fiction authors for the last couple of decades, Neal Stephenson, has just released a brand new book he co-wrote with Nicole Gallen, a historical fiction author. They're going to join me live in the studio coming up next. And you're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
Lars Larson, your dog in the fight.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It is a pleasure to be with you live on the Radio Northwest Network. I'm glad to get your phone calls and emails, and we'll get to those in a little bit. But I have to admit, before I start this interview, I have a bit of a dog in the fight here because I've been reading the books of Neal Stephenson for decades, and I've always enjoyed enjoyed them. And now, I was going to say he's sitting in the studio, but he's standing up as I am as well, along with his current writing partner, Nicole Gallen, who is herself the author of 6 books, mostly historical fiction. And I'll tell you what, why don't I ask Miss both of you at the same time? I don't typically do questions like this, but the two of you seem very different. You write cyberpunk, you write science fiction, Mr. Stevenson and Ms. Gallen, you write historical fiction, and you live on the right coast, and Mr. Stevenson lives on the left coast. So how did the two of you decide to team up on this most recent effort, this book?
It came about because we have the same literary agent, Liz Derensoff, in New York, and she has represented both of us for, well, in my case, since the early 80s. 2002. So
long history.
Yeah. So we go way back with her, and we also happen to share the same editor, Jen Brell at HarperCollins in New York. So there were those connections. And a few years ago, we got involved together in a project called The Mongoliad, which is a big collaborative novel writing effort.
How did those go, Ms. Gallen?
It was a lot of fun. It was sort of like herding cats, because there were 7 of us, and everyone was in Seattle or the Seattle area except for me. We would have Skype sessions. The guys would do Western martial arts together and then get together for a story conference, and I would Skype in and, you know, have a pedicure or something while I was part of the conversation.
I didn't know you were having pedicures.
Yeah, well, I was giving myself pedicures.
Okay.
But that sounds like an interesting collaboration. So the same editor who's working your works, Mr. Stevenson, is working historical fiction as well. That must be a little bit of a jarring experience to go from one to the other, or is it?
She has a catholicity of taste.
Yeah, she's just good at what she does. Jen Brell. It's part of what a good editor does is to have a big brain and be interested in a lot of things. You never know what's going to come your way, come across your desk in the way of a project. And so getting overly focused on one particular kind of writing probably is not the way to do that job.
Probably not, if you're going to make sure you stay employed and keep food on the table. So, Ms. Gallen, tell me about the rise and fall of Dodo, and what does Dodo stand for? Except, do you say D-O-D-O or Dodo?
No, we say Dodo.
Dodo, all right.
That's fine.
And it stands for, because it's a little hard to say.
It stands for the Department of Diachronic Operations.
Ah, and what is that?
It's a super secret government agency that is interested in the use of diachronic travel. Diachronic meaning more than one time period, for their own governmental confidential reasons. And I'm not sure how much to say without it being a spoiler.
If you think of S.H.I.E.L.D. in the Marvel universe or whatever, this ridiculously enormous but totally secret agency that has all kinds of high-tech crazy stuff going on and that's doing things for, you know, strategic operations of various kinds for the government. It's that, except that it's using time travel.
So except for the time travel part, it just sounds like what's currently been in the news for the last 5 or 6 years or 8 or 10 years as we watch and find out about all the super secret government agencies doing things we never knew they were doing before.
Well, a big part of the fun of the book for us writing it, and we hope for readers, is sort of taking that whole kind of bureaucratic mindset and that whole mentality of big organizations in general, but particularly big kind of military industrial complex organizations, and applying it in this crazy area of time travel where your employees are like witches and Vikings and Huns and berserkers and all kinds of strange characters from all around the world.
And as the person with the background in historical novels, you keep Mr. Stevenson on the straight and narrow when it comes to Huns and Vikings and how
the straight and narrow is no fun. But yeah, I'd say we do a pretty good job actually of vetting each other and each other's work. But yeah,
like a Viking never would have reacted that way to this particular situation.
Yeah, absolutely, we would have big thumb wrestling fights about that.
but this sounds like a great collaboration. Does it take you too far from your roots and from the other things you've been writing? I asked you earlier, I said, would it be appropriate to say you're the guy who invented cyberpunk? And you said, no. It you joined that movement, but would you mind describing that? Because I'm a fan, but sure. An awful lot of my audience may not know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, well, cyberpunk was a kind of resurgence of science fiction that happened in the 80s that was basically people taking, I would say, techniques from literary fiction and applying them to science fiction. So you're reading sci-fi, but it's got a kind of noir kind of literary style to it, and it sort of gave science fiction a shot in the arm at a time when it could use that. And it tended to be more about computers and networks and less about rocket ships and blasters and the usual staples of science fiction as we think of it. So Bill Gibson, Bruce Sterling were two of the big names who got it going, and I was a Johnny Come Lately in 1992 with Snow Crash.
And that of course, I mean, that's a fantastic book. I very much appreciated it, and I don't want to get too far. If people want to read it, I want them to read it. I don't want them to hear my interpretation or misinterpretation of it. But where do you take this collaboration from here, Ms. Gallen?
I think we're pretty good with what we've been doing.
Yeah.
I think that's, yeah. I mean, both writing novels is intensely solitary by nature. You sort of generally do it by yourself.
Right.
And it's been fun to have two opportunities to work with Neil in different settings. But I think that the natural place to retreat to is to just write a novel by yourself. So that's what each of us have been doing for the last year, because that's what comes naturally.
Well, so then what happens, Ms. Stevenson, when she calls you up and says, I wanted to go this direction, you say, well, I was thinking more of that direction, so let's not go there? Or do you say we can go both places?
Nikki and I need to make up a fake story about about all the drama and conflict that we had during this so that we could tell more entertaining yarns about it, because it was very easy. It was, you know, we both, from the very beginning, we knew where the story was going, and we had a good feel for the characters and who they were, how they would behave. And so there just those kinds of conflicts just didn't really emerge.
So it's not that hard to draw an arc, Ms. Gallen, to say this is we know where it's going to start. Here's the middle. Here's the end. And we can see a natural progression.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, in many ways, the book is an origin myth. And as with any origin,
what does that mean?
It means that it's the story of how something bigger than itself gets started. So by the end of it, you have to be at that place where the creation is complete and then it's ready to fledge and go off into the world. So the ending is its own kind of beginning. And knowing that, we knew where we had to get to at the end. It wasn't just a premise.
No, it sounds, Mr. Stevenson, let me ask you this, because an awful lot of what science fiction gets credit for is anticipating future developments that are really going to change our lives. Mm-hmm. And today we're finding out we have the possibility that hackers can hack an election, hack a power grid, and all that is now real. It's a real and present danger. They're having hearings on it right now.
Some science fiction books, I think, are a little more prediction-y than others. You know, my previous one was sort of more rooted in hard science, Seven Eves, and how rockets work and that kind of thing. The Rise and Fall of Dodo is more of a fun kind of romp, okay? I mean, it's got enough science in it to sort of get the story started, you know, and kind of provide a basis for the plot, but this is not one I would look to as a predictive kind of novel.
Neil Stevenson is with me right now. Nicole Gallen, we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
Bring honestly provocative talk everywhere you go. Search iTunes for The Lars Larson Show podcast.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It is a pleasure to be with you. We're live on the Radio Northwest Network, 21 stations, Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. And in the studio with me right now is well-known science fiction and cyberpunk author Neil Stevenson. I probably shortchanged him by not going into some of the other aspects of science fiction. And Nicole Gallen, who is his current writing partner in The Rise and Fall of Dodo. And they are going to be at Powell's Books. The store in Beaverton tonight at 7 o'clock. I asked you, Mr. Stevenson, if you wanted to get into where you might go as an author with some of what's currently going on in America right now, which sounds like it was written as a as a fiction novel of some kind.
Well, you know, my uncle and I, back in the early 90s, published a novel called Interface, which was, in some ways, kind of reminds me of current politics. And it's about a popular governor who has a stroke, gets a chip planted in his head, and then they figure out a way to wire the chip up to a polling system. So while he's on live, like if he was on this show, you know, he could get sort of polling data into his brain live, and he could change positions in mid-sentence, you know, or whatever, you know. And so obviously he wins the vote and becomes president. So that's called Interface.
Is that the one you shared? You created a
pen name.
Stephen Burry?
Yeah, Stephen Burry was the combined pen name that my uncle and I used for a while for that collaboration. But since then, they brought it out with my name and his name on the cover.
How did he feel about that?
Well, you can't keep a secret, right? So,
didn't work for King either, did it?
No. So, but at the time, it was before Snow Crash was published. I didn't really have much of a name recognition, and so there was it didn't really matter. You know, it was, using a pen name didn't make any difference at that point.
No. Ms. Gallen, so yes. How, if you were writing this as a historical novelist, you're going to look back on the Trump era 20 or 30 years from now and write it as a historical novel.
Well, I think we've done it several times already. I think real history's done it, but it does seem rather improbable, the whole thing. Bizarrely, I am actually the book that I'm working on right now, which is just a contemporary novel, involves dueling newspapers and bias in the media and small town government and kind of a lot of the nepotism and crazy stuff that can happen. And when I first pitched the idea, I really thought it was just kind of a slapstick comedy, and it's not anymore. I'm like having to sort of change the tone of it in response to what's actually going on in the world. So I think I'll be done with trying to make sense of contemporary politics by the time I have finished that book.
I mean, because you don't have to get to small towns to get nepotism in politics, do you? Or
well,
in media, because
clearly,
I think
right.
of the Rhodes brothers, you know, one in the White House and one at CBS News, and some of those famous examples. But, there are much better examples than that of people where the cross up between politics and media is incredible.
Yeah, certainly in the sort of Southern California media business, there's a lot of that kind of it's about access. It's about, you know, who you know and that kind of thing. And it makes a difference.
It's also about how it gets spun. And I'm about your age. I think I'm 6 months younger than you, Mr. Stevenson. You just aged a whole lot better than me. And I remember when the news cycle was they'd shoot some video during Vietnam, which happened when I was in junior high school and early in high school, and the film would make it back to the United States, it'd be processed, and American eyes would see it 3 days later. Today, I've literally seen where hearings, like the one that's on the screens up above us in the studio, someone will say something, it's instantly on the internet through Twitter, through some other kind of social media, and there's a reaction to it, and literally, you can see the original statement, the reaction, and the reaction to that while the person is still finishing their testimony, as though it's all happening in real time, faster than real time almost.
And there's other kinds of reactions that happen as well. Trump had the tweet, the Covfefe tweet.
Yes,
tweet.
Yes.
Something like 3 minutes later, somebody had actually registered that as a California license plate.
You're kidding.
Yeah, they got the domain name. Yeah, it happened within minutes.
Did it surprise you, the kind of obsession that the media went into for, I think, 16 or 20 hours immediately after
that?
Well,
I think a big part of that was just that he must have fallen asleep right after he hit send on that. So everyone was, like, waiting for the retraction or
follow-up.
For the thing to be erased, right? Because it was obviously some kind of mistake, and it just went on and on and on. And so it's one of those things where it just draws more and more attention the longer it continues.
Do you wonder whether a politician, somebody who's, well, he's very attuned to social media. I always thought that Obama got the credit of being, he's really attuned to social media. Trump seems to know how to manipulate social media very, very well. But somebody who really started to understand that the media is attracted by shiny objects. Hey, look, a squirrel.
Yeah.
And that if you did, if you could really manipulate that, you could just drive these people. You'd have them chasing their tails all day long,
well,
which I think he does.
I think that's what we've got.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, that's exactly the situation that we've got. And so I think there's something to be said for the anecdote you told earlier about the footage coming over from Vietnam or wherever, and there being a little bit of delay loop into the system, you know, so that people can, you know, can maybe see that on the network news in the evening and have some time to digest it, as opposed to being in this nonstop spin cycle.
So what do you go ahead, Matt?
Just also that it used to be curated in a way that it no longer is.
And what's that going to mean for historical novelists in the future? You used to be able to go back and read a letter that somebody sat down and spent 90 minutes writing, and now you're going to be limited to looking 140-character tweets?
No, not necessarily, but there's going to be too much information to sift through. My first novel was, I loved researching it because it's set in medieval Wales, and there's such a limited amount of information about the specific time period that it's set in, that I'm pretty confident I read almost everything there was to read. Not necessarily that I got it right or interpreted it correctly, but I accessed everything there was to access. That's no one's ever going to be able to say that about the early 21st century.
Nicole Galland is one of the two authors. Neal Stephenson is the other. The Rise and Fall of Dodo, you can see him at Powell's Books tonight in Beaverton at 7 o'clock. It's a pleasure to have you both here.
Thanks for having us on.
Yeah.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very, very much. And I'm glad to get back to your phone calls and emails in a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and you're listening to the Lars Larson Show.